You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome to Brookings. We were going to call an audible about 5 minutes ago to move this whole thing outside. Secretary wanted to, but I said, no, we're just going to do this here. It's great to have you here. I'm John Allen. I'm the president of Brookings. And we're very pleased this afternoon to have an honored guest with us, the Undersecretary of the Army, Secretary Ryan McCarthy. Undersecretary McCarthy was unanimously confirmed by the U.S. Senate on August 1st, 2017. And in this role, he acts as the senior civilian assistant and principal advisor to the Secretary of the Army on matters relating to management and the operations of the U.S. Army. It's an extremely important job, as you would imagine, especially in 2019. Previously, he served as a vice president to Lockheed Martin and was the special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, in a previous tour in the Pentagon. It's been my honor to know him now and to respect him deeply for a number of years. And Undersecretary McCarthy is a true and tried veteran of the Department of Defense. And he'd be hard-pressed to find a more dedicated public servant, better professional, to lead the U.S. Army in this important moment. And I have to tell you, when he thinks about the Army, and the Army is, of course, the greatest army this planet has ever seen, he thinks about this enormous organization, but his thoughts very quickly go straight down to the young soldier serving probably in harm's way at the edge of American and Allied influence, and the priority he puts on that soldier and that soldier's family and the mission of the Army to support that individual is unambiguous and it's unrelenting. We could not have a better person in this position. With so many real and potential challenges on the horizon, the U.S. military has no choice but to adapt to an increasingly uncertain future of complex, evolving threats in an environment of increasing technological sophistication and lethality. And I'm thinking artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies. And in that regard, the U.S. Army is no different. The Undersecretary's work is directly linked to making that adaptation happen. And having known Ryan for so long, I can think of no one better qualified and better placed to help deliver our United States Army to where it needs to be, to defend America, to protect our interests, and to support our allies in the 21st century. And I know we're all looking forward to hearing his remarks. And to our program now, Undersecretary McCarthy will shortly offer us his own remarks, and then he'll be joined by Brookings Senior Fellow and Director of Research for Foreign Policy, Mike O'Hanlon. They'll discuss the Army's most recent budget request, its operational outlook, and the role it will play in our national defense strategy, as well as many other issues throughout the conversation. And once they have wrapped up their discussion, we'll come out to you for questions and answers, and a quick reminder that we're very much on the record this afternoon. So, ladies and gentlemen, I could not be happier than to welcome my friend, but to welcome the Undersecretary of the Army, Ryan McCarthy.
Thanks, John, for those overly gracious remarks and the kind introduction. While we were sitting in the back waiting to come out, I actually remembered one of my fondest memories of serving with General Allen. We were leaving King Abdullah's farm out in the countryside, Jandria. We're going to head back to Riyadh, and we ended up sharing the back of a Suburban because it was late at night and Secretary Gates didn't want anybody to ride with him. So the two of us get in one of the trail vehicles, and it's a sandstorm. So all you can see are the blinking red lights of the vehicle in front of you going about 80 miles an hour. And it was about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was a good hour-plus ride. And over the course of that hour and change was an education for me, an education from as competent and as loyal of a teammate as I've ever had and someone who truly became a mentor to me in my time last tour in the Pentagon. So, General Allen, thank you for hosting me today. It's great to see you. And for all the advice you give me since I returned to the Pentagon in this role. To Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for moderating today. There's nobody better in the business and the team here at Brookings. So I especially look forward to engaging in questions and answers after my prepared remarks, so I'll get to the point. 3 days ago, the Army unveiled our budget plan as a part of the overall Department of Defense submission for fiscal year 2020. It's still being assessed and picked over and in some cases picked at, given the significant challenges that it contains. And over the years, this town has heard its fair share of talk about defense transformations, pivots, rebalances, offset shifting paradigms, and much, much more. But if you look at the totality of what we're proposing, it is arguable that this budget plan represents the most consequential shift in the way the U.S. Army is organized and equipped in more than 40 years. A shift towards what is required to compete with, deter, and if necessary, defeat our most likely adversaries in the European and Pacific theaters. So this afternoon, I'll provide the strategic context and real-world rationale underlying the Army's modernization vision, then highlight some of the key shifts and decisions undertaken by the Army leadership team in research, development, and procurement especially, to make the FY20 budget plan executable and affordable. And finally, discuss the extensive modernization opportunities now exist based on these decisions. As a starting point, in some respects, the Army has been in this position before. In the wake of Vietnam, the Army saw a revolution in doctrine, organization, training, and equipping, the latter most famously being the Apache and Black Hawk helicopters, the Bradley Fighting Vehicle, the M1 Abrams tank, and the Patriot Air Missile Defense System, the so-called Big Five, plus the multiple launch rocket system. But the Army must again confront the potential for conflict against a modern military force, which, unlike the United States, has not spent nearly two decades fighting insurgents. Potential adversaries that have studied U.S. strengths and vulnerabilities and are steadily chipping away at our technological advantage. Once again, the great power competition, as the National Defense Strategy puts it, drives our priorities. The People's Republic of China, our long-term strategic pacing threat, is aggressively modernizing capabilities to expand their military reach within and beyond the first island chain. U.S. ships, combat aircraft, and installations in the region are now vulnerable to thousands of Chinese missiles with increasing range and accuracy. For the Army, this puts a premium on integrated air missile defense systems, long-range artillery, and other ground capabilities that can be forward deployed to thwart Chinese attacks, disrupt Chinese movement, and limit Chinese options. To state the obvious, it's very difficult to sink or shoot down an island. Our more immediate high-end pacing threat and the driver of the Army's near-term initiatives for training, equipping, and modernization is the Russian Federation. Russia is able to use its short-term interior lines to project military might beyond its borders and present operational challenges we must respond to incursions against our NATO allies. On the ground, advanced Russian cyber and electronic warfare capabilities can play havoc with our space and network-dependent systems. Sophisticated Russian air and missile defense systems, radars, surface-to-air missiles, and more would hamper air support and movement of U.S. ground forces, and their long-range field artillery and anti-armor weaponry present threats to our heavy formations in ways not seen since the latter years of the Cold War. Both Russia and China are leveraging new tactics and technologies, military and otherwise, to create effective forms of standoff. However, each still faces significant military disadvantages, at least compared to the United States, along with domestic political and economic challenges. But being the proverbial home team means Russia and China just need to inflict high enough costs to cow U.S. allies and damage our credibility. The Army of today, as battle-hardened as it may be, lacks the next-generation weapons and other capabilities that are needed to confront these most sophisticated adversaries as part of a truly joint and networked force. We are reaching the limit of what can be added to and improved on platforms that have been the mainstay of the Army for decades. In all, going to war with the Army you have with another modern military in the future is a losing, if not calamitous, proposition. Consequently, the Army is faced, once again, with the challenge of making the investments and hard choices necessary to win against modern adversaries while recovering and maintaining a high state of readiness. Unlike after Vietnam, we must do so in a way that retains the hard-earned understanding that will allow us to adapt and, if needed, to deal with irregular warfare missions that have inflicted such a steep cost on the Army over the past century. For example, we recognize that the training and advising of militaries of partner nations, whether in a counterinsurgency or peacetime setting, will continue to be an Army requirement. So the Army is committed to the Security Force Assistance Brigades, which were created and manned for just that purpose, so we are not forced to stand up ad hoc structures in the future. To strike the balance, the Army needed first to have the right institutional structures, processes, and priorities in place. In the last 2 years, the service leadership, civilian in uniform, have used the budget relief provided by Congress and this administration in fiscal year 2018 and fiscal 2019 to remedy severe readiness gaps across the force, to include increasing the number of units going through combat center training center rotations, and then defined an institutional concept of how we will fight. In this environment that we've called as a defined threat, we call multi-domain operations, or MDO. We stood up Army Futures Command to focus and rationalize Army modernization by integrating our concepts and capabilities against our priorities, and finally, scrubbed and aligned billions of dollars to the Army modernization portfolio to focus on 6 major priority areas and 30 signature systems. These modernization priorities will get more funding now and protection from becoming bill payers in the future. Investment opportunities exist within our 6 modernization priorities over the 5-year defense plan, or FYDP. A few programs to highlight on each priority are, first, nearly $5.7 billion total, including $1.3 billion in fiscal year 20 for long-range precision fires that will fund fielding hypersonic systems that can stay ahead of recent Russian and Chinese advances and put their forces at risk from a distance. A precision strike missile that doubles the firepower and increases the range of existing missile artillery systems like MLRS and ATACMS. An extended-range cannon artillery with capability to fire accurately with volume in excess of 70 kilometers. Second, more than $13.2 billion, including $2 billion in fiscal year 20, for next-generation combat vehicles, to include a robotic and optionally manned combat vehicle that includes artificial intelligence. Third, more than $4.7 billion, including $800 million in fiscal 20, for future vertical lift to replace the Army's aging helicopter fleet and providing aerial platforms with greater speed, maneuverability, and lethality. Specifically, an attack recon aircraft, a long-range aircraft, with a generational leap in capability, including optionally manned. Fourth, more than $12.5 billion, including $2.3 billion in fiscal year 20, for new command and control communications network that will leverage commercial technologies and space-based systems to provide needed capacity, resiliency, and agility while reducing the force's electromagnetic signature. Fifth, nearly $8.8 billion, including $1.4 billion in fiscal year 20, for modernizing air and missile defense. The Army can no longer presume to operate in an environment, as we have since the fall of the Berlin Wall, in which the U.S. has air supremacy. This will revitalize atrophied short-range air defenses and support procurement of an integrated fire protection capability like Iron Dome and others. Sixth, but certainly not least, more than $6.7 billion, including $845 million in fiscal year 20, for soldier lethality for those at the tip of the spear. This funding supports an integrated visual augmentation system that employs artificial intelligence and digital huge images to give infantrymen superior battlefield awareness, to include real-time performance data to improve decision-making. This is a life-saving system for American soldiers, and Microsoft is fully committed to this program. And a next-generation squad weapon and rifle that will leap beyond the current World War II-era physics still used in most of our small arms. So that brings us to the perennial challenge of any modernization investment strategy: how to pay for it and from where. First, we need to prioritize our requirements for near-term contingencies and long-term threats. Then second, exert the fiscal discipline to divest legacy systems and make tough choices needed to meet those requirements without going back to the White House or Congress for more money. Recognizing that defense budgets will, in all reality, stay relatively flat or potentially decline, resources we need to found within the Army top-line budget, more than $30 billion across the future year's defense plan. So Secretary Esper, General Milley, Vice Chief General McConville, the major commanders, select G codes and assistant secretaries, and myself spent last spring and summer scouring every corner and crevice of the Army budget. The process has been referred to as night court because everyone advocating for a program was required to make their case in person to the four of us, so to be clear, was not a staff product. In over 70 hours of meetings, we went through more than 500 programs in all, looking at each one, assessing and asking ourselves if it was more important than our top modernization priorities, or if the program in question enables the Army to execute multi-domain operations. Nothing was sacrosanct. Over 5 years, added up to real dollars. This includes more than $8 billion in cost avoidance measures, which in English means we found ways to curb the projected rate of spending from prior budget plans. We slowed the Army's projected growth and end strength to 2,000 year over year, starting in FY19 to 476,000, up to 488,000 active component soldiers by fiscal year 2024. This approach means we're not rushing to fill the ranks, and we'll have more consistent quality in our recruiting. We slimmed headquarters and administration functions while adding personnel to areas where they were needed, such as recruiting and military specialties that will be in high demand for the multi-domain fight. Our reform initiatives netted some $22 billion in savings. This included divesting from many incumbent programs, more than 90 programs eliminated and just as many reduced. Many of these systems continue to serve the Army well, but fully funding the present and the future at the same time is simply not possible. So this budget plan stops further production and block upgrades of the Bradley fighting vehicle by fiscal year 2023. Its frame and chassis date from the early 1980s and can no longer accommodate or power the extra capabilities and greater firepower needed to counter Russian defenses without a costly and inefficient overhaul. We are also halting further modernization of the CH-47F Block II cargo helicopter. Although the platform originally dates back to the 1960s, the Army's recent investment in the Block 1 upgrade makes it the youngest fleet in the Army, a de facto service life of less than 8 years. The CH-47F Block 1 provides an extremely capable heavy lift capacity, and the Army currently has over 10% more Chinooks than they need. Finally, the Army is reducing planned spending on the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle Program by nearly $800 million over the FYDP. This reduction will result in roughly 1,900 fewer vehicles procured over the program life. Unlike the Cold War-era platforms just discussed, the JLTV is a new vehicle, more survivable than a Humvee, and more maneuverable than an MRAP. There's no doubt the Army needs it in the future, just not at the numbers of the original program or record, when the requirements of high-intensity land conflict are considered. By 2028, this shift will give the Army a fleet mix of 55,000 Humvees, 49,000 JLTVs, and 800 infantry squad vehicles, more than 100,000 troop transport vehicles in all. Other cuts include everything from trailers, trucks, forklifts, and other equipment. In these cases, it was less a matter of warfighting strategy than the simple fact we had more than was needed. Not every unit, based on their function, needed a full complement of the most advanced and expensive kit. Under this plan, the share of Army modernization budget will shift, slowly but inexorably, from production and upgrade of existing systems, about 80% of the portfolio now, to new programs and capabilities, which should make up roughly half of all modernization funding by fiscal year 2023. Forthright and ruthless realism underscored these decisions, and our leadership team has pledged that if the Budget Control Act-driven cuts return, if risk must be taken in the Army, let the risk be taken elsewhere, not in the weapons and equipment of our soldiers will need to fight and win. It was not lost on us in the consequences associated with these decisions, nor the symbolism. FY20 marks where the Army began to transition from the Big Five and many other legacy systems developed since towards capabilities designed and needed for the 21st century. To be sure, there will be some economic dislocation as a result of slowed or, in some cases, shuttered production lines. But as I illustrated in that earlier and purposely long, discussion of the areas where funds are being added for future growth, this budget plan presents a tremendous opportunity as well, especially for those in industry who are willing to step up their R&D investments, innovate, and partner with us in the future. In all, more than $57 billion over the course of this FYDP are dedicated to the modernization priorities and our signature programs, not including opportunities such as artificial intelligence, directed energy, quantum computing, and space. Looking ahead, when it comes to the Army reform and change, we are, to paraphrase Churchill, closer to the end of the beginning than vice versa. As Secretary Esper has said, the Army's industrial age personnel system is the next big institutional reform priority. The Army will take a hard look at its force structure as well, the balance between heavy and light, fire and maneuver, the number and composition of brigade combat teams and other formations. And we will continue to press ahead with the organization reforms and efficiencies, with a savings target of $10 billion starting in FY21 through FY25. Even as we make this long-needed shift to modernization, the focus on readiness will not waver in equipping, training, and sustainment. It remains job one. The plan just discussed extends past individual Army leaders and even administrations. And like anything else in government, it will be affected by fiscal circumstances beyond our control. And like anything else in government, it will be affected, I can say with some certainty, that the core elements and main strategic choices in the fiscal years 18, 19, 20, and the work beginning in fiscal year 21, with the support of this administration and Congress, will set shifts in motion that cannot be easily undone. Changes designed to field the Army capabilities needed by 2028. Understanding innovation reform will and must continue beyond the next decade. And let there be no doubt, the Army leadership, uniformed and civilian, with the full backing of Acting Secretary Shanahan and General Dunford, own this budget, believe in this budget, and will fight for it. That much we owe our soldiers and the families, those who have borne the brunt and human costs of America's war since 9/11. Together, we'll face those threats that lie ahead. Thank you for your time this afternoon. I look forward to your questions.
Mr. Secretary, that was great. Thank you. And you covered a lot. I just wanted to give you a chance to maybe amplify and go into a couple of details on several of the topics, and then we'll go to the audience. I'll try to be pretty brief because a lot of people here want to get in on the fun. And I want to thank you for all you've been doing. I think one theme that emerges when the top line debate about the Trump administration budget proposal for defense for 2020 is that it's a big increase. That, like you said, the Army is trying to make do with, in some cases, less, or in many ways, a flat line, and you're emphasizing the number of programs you've reassessed and cut. I wanted to first compliment you on that, but also give you a chance to talk about one or two of the other things that are in the budget documents that came out this week, but that we didn't quite hear about in your speech because you were being mercifully short and to the point. I was really struck that you have found a way in the last several years to reduce the number of non-deployable soldiers. And we were talking about that earlier. I wondered if you could explain, for those who haven't read the budget, the Army used to have 15% of all of its soldiers categorized as non-deployable at any given moment, just in the year 2015. And now that number is down to 6%, which makes a huge difference if you're trying to get the readiness levels of all your units up, because you don't want to have to steal from Peter to get Paul's unit in good shape and thereby make Peter's even less ready than it was. So I wondered if you could explain a little more about that that transformation.
Well, nothing gets you focused like having a Secretary of Defense that commanded a Marine division. So when Secretary Mattis took the helm,
We work this issue almost every week. So anytime you were near him in a staff meeting, it was finger in the chest. What does it take? It starts with leadership. Former Secretary Mattis was just unrelenting in this, that these are assets on the books. You got to make sure that every asset is ready to go. So he got all of the service leadership, he and the chairman, everybody singularly focused. So first and foremost, it started there. And really, you had to take a look at how did you account for it? When you look at the root cause associated with non-deployables, one of them was if you were within 60 days of a deployment and you didn't have your teeth checked, you're non-deployable. And so staff meetings would start out with, well, we got Gunny at the front door and you're rifling them through there to get their teeth checked. So we started to look at simple things within a training calendar. How do you get people to flow through there to get their teeth looked at? They come off that Category 4, and then they get back in that deployment status because they're obviously healthy, fit, ready, trained soldiers. So there was a substantial chunk there. We put physical trainers and nutritionists at battalion level. We're taking greater emphasis of when a soldier gets hurt, how do you quickly assess and then get them back into that status? Because, we at times in combat arms units, I twisted my knee. Well, here's a bag of Motrin. Get back in there. Well, they might have a tear in their ACL, So simple things like that, but a particular focus on the key root causes and a lot of leadership.
And speaking of the way you've prioritized readiness, I notice in the budget documents, and I think you alluded to it in your speech, that you've now got 26 of your brigade combat teams up to what you consider a high tier or a top tier of readiness. I think that's just up from 19 the year before, and maybe even as low as 6 or 10 a few years ago. Your goal is to get, you have about 55 in the entire force structure, right, including the National Guard. So what's your goal and what's the time horizon for sort of recovering Army readiness?
So by FY22 is when we believe we'll have, under current assumptions, to have about two-thirds of those brigade combat teams at the highest level of readiness. And again, there's some things. Obviously, you need to continue to grow. There are variables in the equation. Having enough troops in the formation, funding to train, to increase home station training, combat center training rotations. But it's also, again, the leadership aspect. And I look at General Milley, and I know General Abrams has moved on to U.S. Forces Command, but they were absolutely laser-focused on this and how they looked at all of the types of factors you had to get through to get a unit through all the wickets as quickly as possible. So they increased those individual repetitions and collective tasks, but really locking in on those training calendars. And what was really a joy for me is when I would travel around the Army and meet with a battalion commander, they sounded exactly like Milley, but just without a Bostonian accent. They knew exactly what they needed to do. So it was some key factors that they focused in on, and they did it very well.
Now, you said you're still doing reviews of the mix of forces and the size of the force structure, but at the moment, you're not asking, I don't believe, for more structure. You're not asking for more brigade combat teams, and you're only making very modest requests for additional soldiers, in some striking contrast to the Air Force, which has done a big study in the last few months, asking for a 25% expansion in its combat force structure. We had General Goldfein here to speak recently about that. Why does the Army feel that its force structure is adequate, at least for the moment, reserving the right to reassess as you do your future studies? But how did you come to that conclusion, and how did you come to the conclusion that you can make do with an Army of less than 500,000 active duty soldiers?
Well, we're still trying to stay on track to get to 500,000. We won't reach that in this fit-up, but the trajectory is still in that cardinal direction. But what I would say is we're changing our operating concept, multi-domain operations. We have 30 signature systems that we're bringing into the formations so that bringing forward a new operating concept and these new technological advances, we're going to change the structure over time. We're heading on this particular azimuth, but you're going to change downstream. So I say this repeatedly. There's about four or five officers that are driving this. It's our military deputy ASOL, Paul Ostrowski, Lieutenant General Ostrowski, Lieutenant General Jimmy Richardson, the Deputy Commander of Futures Command, Lieutenant General Lundy out in TRADOC, and then and Eric Wesley, Futures and Concepts.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, between putting the threat together with the operating concept and these new systems, That's where you're going to see the trades, and then we'll have to adjust the force structure downstream. Historically, we're making everybody read about how we brought together air, land, battle, and the big five, that we initially brought these five weapon systems into the formations, but we realized the big five was really the big 64 because they had HETs and they had HEMETs and they had all these other things to enable those systems. We're going to learn that the same way they did, and we're making those adjustments. But you're honing in on those 30, and that will ultimately change the structure with underneath it.
The six priorities, the six broad categories, long-range fires, vertical lift, vehicles, soldier lethality, the network, and air and missile defense. Out of those six, are there any where you think the technology is particularly exciting, where you would really say, now is a moment we can do some dramatic things? Or are these more all six sort of areas that you're just going to keep slogging away, trying to, you know, increase the pace of the slogging and trying to buy fewer Bradleys and other previous generation systems to free up funds? But is there any area where you would say there's some big opportunity and or a big vulnerability that you really want to get after even more than in some of the others?
So the one I'm most excited about is hypersonics. We have a great partnership going on within the department. We have is a joint interest program where we put a memorandum of agreement together with the Navy, the Air Force, and Missile Defense Agency. We're working together, learning from each other, doing some joint testing. We've demonstrated this capability a couple times over the last 10 years, but there's so much energy and resources available to really make a go of it right now, and I'm very encouraged by the plan that was that they showed us the other day. So I think a lot of excitement there. Challenge the network. You know, I think from a communications architecture, we have a big experiment coming up this summer. So you know, I'm going to stay tuned to that and see how we perform. Because if you can't reduce our electromagnetic signature, and if we can't have a resilient network in place, that will present a significant challenge. And as I talked about, near-peer competitors, the types of investments they made, that's the first place they go. Mm. Try to mitigate that capability and create confusion and disruption. So you've heard the numbers I laid out there for investment, so it's a place where we'll get particular emphasis by the leadership to drive that through the modernization knothole.
One last question for me, and then we'll go to all of you. I see in the budget documents that also you've now, and we were talking about this when you hosted a few of us over at Army headquarters recently, that you're changing the way you do brigade level exercises to really try to account for vulnerability, vulnerability in the cyber network, but also vulnerability to direct attack of a command post. And I noticed in the budget document that you're making headquarters get up and reposition every day or so, even when you're doing a three-week-long exercise. I just wanted to invite you to say anything more about that, because that strikes me as a pretty important change.
So, again, the chief's leadership and General Abrams, when he was driving ForceCom, they tried to make these scenarios as difficult and as complex as possible, and with whether it's chemical attacks, jamming communications, to see how the units embrace mission command, and getting back to the fundamentals of operations orders and commander's intent. So it's really remarkable that shift that's been made over the last 3 years. So between the leadership and then the infusion of funding that came in the 2018-19 bill, it's really helped us put a lot of energy behind readiness.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. I want to now open up the floor. So please wait for a microphone, and we'll take maybe, you want to do one at a time or two? What's your pref?
See how long I can handle that, right?
Okay. We'll try a couple, and we'll start here with the gentleman in the white shirt in the second row, and then the gentleman over here in the fourth row, and then come back to the undersecretary.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Akhal Malik. I'm a Fulbright scholar, currently at the SIGA Center, and I'm working on changing global order. And that being the basis for all the preparation readiness, I'd like to get your understanding about the engagement. What possible engagements do you envisage? Because it's primarily going to be a lot like the Cold War, where you realize that you can't engage each of those countries directly, and mostly in the peripheral areas and other countries. And are you getting ready for that, more importantly? Because you've been engaged in other countries lately like that in the last couple of decades. And so it's actually building on that in a way, because directly engaging with other countries is an impossibility in the future order, I think.
So a little bit of a contrarian take to the prevailing assumptions of the National Defense Strategy. And then we'll go over here for one more and then come back to the Secretary.
Afternoon, sir. Thanks for the talk. Mike Filanowski from the Army Future Studies Group. Do you see any opportunities in the future for modernization efforts interagency and then with allies? We know that future warfare will be fought with allies and as part of the joint force. Thank you.
So the first was on engagement, right? To your point about our forward footprint and the way we partner with allies is where we believe that it's a formula that's worked for us for 70 years. And it's something that the deterrence factor is where we know that the key investments that we make here, whether it's the way we organize and train and equip ourselves or how we conduct ourselves with our partners, those, if you see the essence of our investment strategy, that's where we believe we can still use that successful formula in the future. And then the future with allies, we are in talks right now. Since we developed Army Futures Command, it's been overwhelming with NATO allies that want to put liaisons in Army Futures Command. We're coming forward with a concept of how we're going to do that. We're 7 months into the stand-up of a four-star command, and like General Murray says, he's a merger managing a startup is what he refers to, and it really is that case. So as soon as he kind of smooths out and goes fully operational capable this summer, it is our intention to work as closely as possible, in particular with NATO allies.
So let's take another round. We'll have the gentleman here in the third row. We'll stick in the third row, and then we'll move back for subsequent rounds. So this gentleman here, and then over across the way.
Thank you, sir. My name is Neil Chabon. I'm with the American Legion. And I wanted to ask you what your opinion was on what are the major roadblocks between advancing technologies, advancing science, technology budgets, and more specifically, budget allocations for those, because in the process that we recently released, allocated in terms of at least the Army's perspective, I believe 8% of the total budget towards science, technology, advanced weapons development, et cetera. So I know that when you're talking about billions of dollars, it's hard to say what's a lot, what's a little, but I think you can somewhat derive priorities and urgency from percentages. So like I said, it was 8% in terms of the Army, and I believe on the total budget of all defense, the DoD budget was 4% in total for science technologies, computer intelligence advancements, et cetera. So what do you think is the major roadblock and a disconnect between generals and people of your position like advocating for the push towards AI, hypersonics, cyber warfare, that future wars are going to be fought behind keyboards and not necessarily on sand? So why is there that disconnect between budget allocation and all the pleas of people in your positions and the like and the actual procurement in terms of money allocation and funds?
You wanted to take that one?
Yeah, sure. We stood up an artificial intelligence task force because it is as much understanding the technology as conditioning our force to that unique technological application and how will we first understand it and then see how it will fit in our operating concepts. With respect to specifically the volume of investment in S&T, dramatic increase. This is, if you look at inflation adjusted, we're about as high as we've been in the history of the department in this budget. But a lot of it is how do we take those dollars and work with commercial industry, because 50, 60 years ago, the Department of Defense was really the driver for S&T worldwide. Today, we're a player. It's breathtaking, the change in scale. So what our Army Futures Command in particular is trying to do is be that bridge to academia and business to work together on these types of investments, because in many cases, they're going to have better folks at a particular discipline than we have organic to the force. So it's a lot about partnerships. We are increasing the budgets, but there's a lot of fiscal uncertainty. Country's $22 billion in debt. We got a Budget Control Act out there. So there's, if you look in the out years, there is uncertainty. It's why we've taken the measures that we have to finance within this current top line. Because if you look at year over year, to Mike's point, it's flat, $182 billion. We actually enacted $179 last year to an OCO debate and base. So our thought was, if you're looking at this downstream, if it's a continuing resolution, we're going to try to survive within that allocation no matter what comes our way, to try to have as much control over our future as we can, and the ruthless prioritization that went about that. But I think right now the leadership uniform of the civilian, they are embracing it. It's just getting organized and focused against that particular application. History shows you how hard it was for us to bring unmanned aerial systems into the formations. And it was that, you know, if you look at the Predator Reaper class system, incredibly lethal platform that performed really well for us over the last 17 years, about a dozen years. These take time, but there's a lot of folks pushing.
Thank you. Take this question over here in the third row and then work our way back, please. No, here, I'm sorry, up here in the third row. Thanks.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Daniel Gagliano. I'm a graduate student at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Study. You talked a lot about the modernization that needs to happen within the technology. I'm curious what kind of changes need to happen within the education and training, and then how long that will take.
So we have stood up a talent management task force about 2-3 years ago in the Army. And some of it is just we have to collect more data on our people. So we have a better sense of what do you really have in front of you. You know, historically we get these little officer record briefs, and it has like your assignments on there. It's like 82nd, 101st, 101st. You might have, he's perfect, you know. You don't really know what you got on your hands here. So collecting data on individuals so they can see themselves and then we can see them more clearly, you might be able to better understand the individual, what are their skills, and then is their chemistry. So first and foremost, we're developing a system that can help us get better, collect more data on individuals and help us make better decisions on people. But it'll also create almost a marketplace for them to manage their careers more effectively. So you got a more productive, happier employee. We're also looking at investments. If you look at a second lieutenant year group, 4,000 of them come into the queue. You need 450 colonels at the end, and 45 of them become a one-star. So the make-or-break moment, we really need, if you're from just a big scale developing people, you really got to know what does it take to make a very effective lieutenant colonel and colonel, just from an officer standpoint, because those are the people running the Army. And what are the investments you have to make? Because if they stay after 5 years, you got 15 years to make one, or even less for lieutenant colonel. So those are the types of exercises they're undergoing, and those are the big investments that Dr. Esper and the chief want to make from 21 and out.
By the way, if I could just take a quick moment on that before we go to another question from the audience and ask you to talk about the state of people and your soldiers. And Brendan Stickles at Brookings, the Navy fellow, has written eloquently about the new retirement system, which I think is helping with some of your retention. And your recruiting, I think, last I heard when Secretary Esper was last here, said things looked reasonably good. But I wondered if you could comment on how you're doing with recruiting and retention and the overall adequacy of the soldier pool that you're now building in the U.S. Army.
Retention's going very well, but I'll focus on recruiting. We missed by 6,500 folks in the active force last year. And it clearly resonated all throughout the halls of the Marshall Corridor. And we took a very hard look at ourselves. And as much as we need to grow, as much as we need to get up to north of 500,000 people in the active force, we had to take a look at ourselves of how fast can we get there with the level of quality that we need. And in an environment with 3.9% unemployment, and an environment where, you know, in many cases, if you look at this millennial generation, are we communicating to them effectively about who we are as an institution, what we do, our value system? So we changed our strategy. We went back to the cities. We're focusing on 22 cities in the country. We changed our messaging. We hired an outside firm to help us with micro-targeting. So how do we study the geography of a suburbs of a big city or a neighborhood in a big city, and how do we better understand to them and so we can communicate to them who we are? We selected a couple of big cities, Chicago in particular, because if you look at the ethnic breakdown of the demographics of the city, it's a pacing item for us in the country. And just within the first 100 days, it improved our leads by 10%. So we've really are overhauling how we communicate, we're overhauling how we recruit, and we're focusing back to the cities. And if I had the data here, I could show you, for the first time in years, we're doing better in Portland, Los Angeles, New York City, Houston. So we're pretty excited about that. And then the slowing of the in-strength growth as we get our new processes in place, and we continue to bring on great quality and grow at a pace where it's much more easier to manage.
Great, thank you. A little further back, let's see if we start way in the back there, please, Adam, and then we'll come back towards the front.
Hello, sir. Jeremiah Rosman, National Security Analyst at the Association of the U.S. Army. I wanted to ask you, how has accelerated urbanization and the rise of megacities informed the Army's future force structure and modernization priorities?
So this has been in General Milley's wheelhouse to answer. He talks about this consistently. He uses this as a planning variable for high-intensity conflict. So this is something where when he coaches and mentors the cross-functional teams, when they come through every week, this is consistently something that he discusses. So it's in all of the formulas for all the weapon systems we're designing.
Fantastic. I know that was a big priority of General Odierno and commissioned the 2014 study on megacities. So that remains part of your thinking even as you try to think about more specific sort of old-fashioned scenarios with the Baltic states or Korea. You're still thinking about just operating in a large urban area for whatever the reason, whether it's a fight, whether it's a complex humanitarian disaster. That's still central. Okay, let's see. Here in the seventh or eighth row, right next to you. Yes, please.
Thank you for your time, sir. Drew Podgorski, Renaissance Strategic Advisors and Infantry PL in the National Guard. Looking at the FY20 end strength numbers, is there any incremental churn baked in from the introduction of the ACFT standards? And is leadership committed to enforcing that through all three components? Are there any tangible changes being made, particularly in the reserve and guard component, where there's less of an appetite to chapter folks out for failing to meet PT standards?
And since we have a no acronym rule here, before you give up the microphone, explain what an ACFT is.
The Army Combat Fitness Test, sir.
Thank you.
Well, he doesn't look like he's going to have a problem with it. I mean,
the purple tie is a little questionable.
So I'm sure you've seen the way they're going to roll in the Army Combat Fitness Test. It's across all components, and we intend to enforce it. So clearly, you look like you're getting after it. So I'm not worried about you.
And I think there was a hand just behind that row. Stay out there for a while. Yes, please.
Hello, Mr. Secretary. My name is Alec Jackson. I'm a legislative analyst at Dynetics. I was wondering if any guidance has come forward within the Army about whether the precision missile strike program is now good to go ahead of the 500 kilometers of the INF now that the INF is on its way out. And I also wanted to know if there's been any discussion of the Army getting roped into the nuclear mission again now that the INF is on its way out. Thank you.
With respect to PRISM, we did talk to various manufacturers that are competing for this capability because, it's the ATACMS replacing precision strike missile. They have indicated that it's a software issue, that they have a squirt of software, that the current platform as designed could exceed the range of the INF treaty. Beyond that, we have not given any instructions for them to do so. But it was just what would it take sort of question. With respect to the nuclear mission, there have been no discussions at my level.
Okay, we got the gentleman here in the red tie in the fifth row, and I'm going to make a plea to the women in the room that I'm going to get in big trouble at home tonight if I haven't called on any women. So please get some questions, and we'll come to you next. Sir.
David Wu, former member of Congress. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Could you please expand on your comments about the threat assessment in Europe and Asia and Army responses?
So the threat assessment in Europe and Asia, I mean, if you look at Russia, which would be our near-term pacing threat, They're having significant challenges with their economy. I mean, they've challenged our elections, Venezuela, the Arctic. Just about in every direction you look, there have been, whether it's issues or proxy issues associated with the Russian Federation. So we're clearly watching that very closely. Our relationship with our NATO allies, we are right there on the border with them. So with respect to China, we've had challenges, obviously, in cyberspace and as well as in space. So I think that these are the sorts of phase zero, if you will, issues that you deal with near peers. And the investments that we make for deterrence are necessary. And so this is what we've referred to consistently with our cross-functional teams is we're going to make the investments and choices to have best in breed and put them in our formations to continue to have that deterrence that we've enjoyed for so many years.
Yes, ma'am, in the blue.
Sir, good to see you. Haley Britsky with Task and Purpose. You mentioned in your opening remarks a couple of the programs that are getting cut, such as the JLTV and upgrades to the Bradley. I was wondering if you could go into a little bit more detail about some of the other programs that are being eliminated or kind of reduced and some that have not been previously discussed, perhaps.
We've truncated the buys on 50 caliber machine guns. We've truncated the buys on forklifts, trailers, support equipment to aviation units. There's 186 programs, so it'd probably be best to get you some information on that.
That's still a nice little sampling. Thank you. I hope you didn't cut Frisbees, though. I'm a big fan of the Army Ultimate Frisbee team. We'll go here to the fifth row.
It'll make my list for 21.
Okay. Hi, Kevin O'Neill from the GAO. Sir, I was wondering if you talk about any force structure plans or changes at echelons above brigade, division, or corps level, particularly with the Russia threat, as you've described it? Is that something the Army's looking at? Anything forward station, perhaps? What's the Army's thinking on that? And are brigade combat teams training at that level, at the division or the corps level, combined arms, excuse me, when they go through combined training rotations?
So General Milley has increased the number of war fighters where the division and corps level exercises. So that's increased as well as the combat training center rotation. So to the above brigade level, they have increased those. So there's your kind of collective training exercise for division corps commanders. With respect to forward basing, Undersecretary Rood was in Europe this week with discussions about Poland. I know that in the Asia-Pacific, conversations are underway with allies as well. But that is clearly something that we're looking at, keenly interested in, but obviously want it to be a partnership and however those investments would go down and what is the type of force presence that would be needed forward.
Great. I think we have time for one or two more questions, so we'll see if we have a hand or two left. Over here, please, and take these two, and then we'll give you one last chance to wrap, if that's okay.
Hi, my name is Amy Gaskill, and I'm retired Coast Guard. I have a question with how are you thinking strategically, or what are your conversations at the table on this administration's foreign policy as you're working through some of these conversations? So,
could you be more specific, please?
The relationships in across the world and all that. I mean, how do you have those kinds of conversations at the table with the relationships that have changed under this administration?
And then we'll take this one. Go ahead.
I periodically, when allies are stateside, I don't do as much overseas travel in this job. I'm kind of the inside guy. As far as I get is to up here or to over there on the other side of town, over there by the hill. So, but I meet with allies consistently when they come to the building. There are many relationships that I've had that stretch over a decade. We have over 30,000 troops in Europe, 28,000 in Korea, 37,000 in the Middle East. So partnerships are very strong, Army to Army right now, and that's about the vantage point that I have and the relationships that I work. So we feel pretty good about it right now.
Thank you. And then the final question will be here.
Hi, Connelly, National Defense. Going back to the question about program cuts, I know you highlighted some items, but could you go into a little bit more detail on potential timelines for replacing other big five items?
So the Bradley is really the first, if you will, future vertical lift, which I highlighted in the prepared remarks. It's going to be just outside of the FYDP, this FYDP, the one we've submitted, where you'll start if fielding goes according to the programmatic timelines that have been presented so far, that it'd be the 26, 27 time frame. So you'd be entering that FYDP to replace ultimately the assault aircraft. The armed reconnaissance is essentially replacing the Kiowa. So that would be the future vertical lift portfolio. We talked about armored vehicles. Those would be the near terms, the ones that would be the most significant in the near term.
On behalf of John Allen and myself and all the friends at Brookings, please join me in thanking the Undersecretary of the Army.